are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Two grisly murders, a brutal double parricide, a suicide, and a fourth death under suspicious circumstances. Drifting into darkness is a tangled tale of family dysfunction, fatal attraction, and greed. A saga that wends its way from the elegant southern mansions of Montgomery, Alabama, to the new age salons of Boulder, Colorado, to rural, windswept Wyoming. On Thanksgiving weekend in 2004, philanthropists Charlotte and Brent Springford Sr., a wealthy, socially prominent Montgomery couple, were brutally beaten to death with an axe handle. Echoing the infamous case of Lizzie Borden, suspicion quickly fell on the Springfords' gifted but troubled son, Brent Jr., who would be tried and sentenced to life without parole. But a mystery remained. Who was the mysterious, elusive woman who claimed to be a Native American shaman that investigators believe manipulated Brent into this murder? Journalists solving murders is a time-tested trope in movies, mysteries, and on television. But cops and cop reporters know that rarely happens in real life, except when it does. Veteran crime reporter Mark I. Pinsky, who covered the sensational cases of serial killer Ted Bundy and Green Beret Dr. Jeffrey McDonald, broke the cardinal rule of journalism by involving himself in the story. Pinsky's extensive research prompted investigators to invite him to join their dogged pursuit of justice. His access to unique and heartbreaking behind-the-scenes material enables him to take readers with him into the troubled, tortured minds of the case's main players. The book that we're featuring this evening is Drifting Into Darkness, Murders, Madness, Suicide, and a Death Under Suspicious Circumstances, with my special guest, journalist and author, Mark I. Pinsky. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview, Mark I. Pinsky.
Dan, thank you very much for inviting me. I'm glad to be here.
Thank you so much. This is an incredible tale, and we talked about your incredible access makes this true crime essential reading. Let's get right to the Springfords in this Garden District, as you write, of Montgomery, Alabama. And you take us immediately to Thanksgiving 2004, November 26th. And a subcontractor, Michael Shelton, and his workers pull up to this address, this affluent home. What do Sheldon and his crew discover? They have had access to this home, and they've been working, and they know the family well. Tell us what happens, what they find.
Well, when they pull up, they were getting ready to complete some of the renovations that were happening in the house. And first, they were somewhat concerned because there were some unlocked doors, and the key that they had for the actual house was not working. It appeared that a bolt had been thrown from inside. So they went through the garage and found an entrance in there, and they walked into the kitchen area where they were doing some tiling work, and they shouted to let people know that they were there, let Brent and Charlotte know that they were there. They got no answer. They were able to reach through a window pane, which was removable, unthrow the bolt, and walk into the kitchen. Again, they shouted that they were here just so people wouldn't be surprised. They weren't sure whether the Springfords would be at home or not. But as they walked through the first floor of the house, they noticed things were in disarray. They first noticed that when they went through the garage, that Brent Sr.'s office appeared to be somewhat in disarray, and he was known as a very neat person. So they were somewhat concerned, but it was a holiday weekend, so they didn't get too concerned. They went into the kitchen, saw no one, and walked through the first floor and saw papers strewn throughout the place. There was some foreboding because there was still no answer when they called upstairs to let them know they were there. And so with that sense of foreboding, the lead contractor walked up the back stairs. And when he reached the landing, he stopped suddenly because the carpet at the top of the stairs was saturated with blood, and not just a little blood, a lot of blood. Mm-hmm. And he knew something very wrong had happened. He went back down the stairs and told his workers not to go upstairs. He then called Brent Sr. on the cell phone. He had his number because the contractor also worked for Brent Sr. for a time at their soft drink bottling company. There was no answer, so more concerned. When there was no answer, the contractor then called the Montgomery Police Department and said they thought something very wrong had happened. At first, they thought maybe it was a burglary, an armed robbery, a home invasion robbery that had gone wrong, but there were nothing else that they could see. And so the police said, leave the premises, wait out front. We'll get there as soon as we can. And it was a holiday weekend, so there were some people who were actually officers and detectives who were at home. And so they were called in, and it took about 30 or 40 minutes for the police to arrive, both uniforms and detectives. They went in, they went through the kitchen door, they went upstairs, they saw the huge area of blood. They knew something terrible was wrong. And so they called back to the precinct and said, we need some homicide detectives. We think that there's a murder of some sort. Their first thought was, it was a murder-suicide. It might have been the simplest explanation for the physical evidence that they first saw. In the next hour or so, they then ventured along the hallway in the second floor. And the first thing they saw was the body of Brent Springford Sr. He had been beaten to death. They didn't know with what at the time. It later turned out to be a pickaxe handle. But also his throat was cut almost to the point of decapitation. And he was surrounded by blood in this area. They ventured further down the hall to the master bedroom, where they found the body of Charlotte Springford, who had also been beaten to death, who also was stabbed multiple times, including in the throat. And in this case, however, there were defensive wounds on her arms that they could recognize right away. Unlike Brent Sr., there were no defensive wounds on him. Mm-hmm. He apparently was set upon in a furious attack. But this time, Charlotte Springford either saw something happening or knew something was happening, and she tried to defend herself. There was physical evidence that after she was beaten to the ground and stabbed, she still tried to drag herself in the direction of the telephone, but she didn't make it.
Investigators find out that there's a daughter, Robin, and a son, Brent Jr., and also that the Jaguar is missing. So how do investigators proceed with this investigation?
Well, they first tried to reach Robin and also Charlotte's half-sister, Lois Truss, who lived in Birmingham, where they had spent the Thanksgiving dinner. And at the same time they were making these calls, neighbors, seeing the police vehicles and then the yellow tape that went up, began congregating on the lawn and on the front, in the street in front of them. And so other detectives began to chat with the neighbors to see if they had any leads. And among them were some close friends of the Springfords who said, take a close look at their son, Brent Jr. He's been estranged from the family living out in Colorado. So that went into the factors of the initial discussions. And as the investigators called family members, the family members also pointed toward Brent Jr. But the problem for the police is that as far as they knew, Brent was 2,000 miles away in the area of Boulder, Colorado. So they began making phone calls. They were also concerned, the family was concerned, that Brent Jr. not only had killed his parents, but he might have in mind to kill his sister and other family members. So the family members on their own went into hiding in case that Brent Jr. was still around and might be after them. So the police immediately, to protect lives, they sent squad cars to protect Lois Truss's house and in other places in thought that maybe he would come there, that it was Brent Jr. and that he would come there. The family owned a lake house. They went out to the lake house. But at the same time, they were making calls out to Colorado where they knew that Brent had a home. And they were asking local sheriff's deputies to go out and see if he was there. And so all this was happening. There was a lot of, I won't say confusion, but the victims were really wealthy, prominent people. So a lot was at stake for the police department this is a horrible thing. You know, people in a neighborhood like the Garden District being murdered in their homes, had a very high screw up.
So police speak to Robin, and what do they find out from Robin concerning the brother, Brent Jr., and just the dynamics of the family especially at Thanksgiving.
Well, they found out that Robin and her husband, Greg, Charlotte and Brent Sr. had had a Thanksgiving dinner at the home of Charlotte's half-sister, Lois Truss, in Birmingham. And the family was happy to gather together because Lois Truss's daughter had just gotten married. So there were two newlywed couples. It was very happy, but there was, in a sense, an empty chair at the Thanksgiving table. And that chair would have been for Brent Jr., but he was estranged from the family. So the estrangement really, when speaking to the people who were around the table, that estrangement really sort of hung over the whole event. So Robin, again, was convinced that only one person could have done this. It wasn't a random act. It wasn't a home invasion. It was her brother who did it. She didn't know how it happened or where it happened, but she was convinced that it was her brother who was responsible. And also, Robin was also concerned, a concern she gave to the police, that initially Robin and Greg were supposed to come back to the Springfords home in Montgomery with her parents to go off together. But at the last minute, Robin and her husband decided not to go with them. And Robin was very much concerned that if she and her husband had gone back with her parents, that she and her husband would have been murdered as well.
So what do investigators do to be able to speak to Caroline Scout?
Well, they called Brent Jr.'s partner, caregiver, and as it turns out, wife, in Colorado, who's living in the house that the Springfords had given them, and wanted to know where Brent Jr. was. And at first, this woman's name is Caroline Scout. She said, oh, he's around here somewhere. And they asked how long she had seen him. Was she sure? She said, oh, yes, he's been here all week. He called in sick at work on Wednesday night, the Wednesday before the Thursday of Thanksgiving. And he's been around here all week. So the police, you know, are used to people telling the truth or not telling the truth. And they asked the local sheriff's department in Colorado to go out and check out the place, the house, to see if he was actually there. Two deputies went out there. They looked around. They saw a car that was registered to Brent, but they couldn't find Brent. And they questioned Caroline Scout's three adult children, two adults and one adolescent, who were living in the house. And they all reaffirmed that, in fact, Brent had been there all week. So the police were first puzzled. And then another young man who was living at the house, a boarder, actually, took one of the police aside and said, you should call me at my work. I'll be able to speak more freely. And when they did that, he said, I haven't seen Brent for a week. And so police became concerned. They still weren't ready to make a move. The Montgomery police were not ready to get on a plane quite yet until the Jaguar was discovered in outside of Tulsa, Oklahoma, which kind of began to connect the dots for the investigators in Montgomery. There was the missing Jaguar that had been in the garage in Montgomery. And after the murder, it shows up in Tulsa, Oklahoma, which is pretty much two-thirds the way back to Colorado. They thought they were kind of closing in on their suspect.
Now, what do investigators find about the dynamics of Brent Jr., his family life? Brent Sr., this wealthy businessman, and mother Charlotte. What was their personalities and how they contributed to this dynamic?
Well, the Springfords, Brent Sr. and Charlotte, were really well beloved in Montgomery. They were philanthropists. They had made a lot of money, but they weren't, you know, grabby, selfish people. They tried to share their wealth in many ways. Even when they traveled, they were very progressive. Now, this is 2004, but earlier, Montgomery can be a very conservative place and was a very conservative place, particularly regarding racial equality. But both Brent Sr. and Charlotte were known as being very progressive people on race, very open to various people in town. When the Southern Poverty Law Center located in Montgomery, a lot of the establishment people kind of shunned them, but Brent and Charlotte did not. They made them welcome. And so they were beloved for their gifts. They were beloved for their civic involvement. And the great tragedy, as their close friends knew, was a long-term estrangement from their oldest son, Brent Jr. And they had done everything their friends knew to support him as he was growing up He was not a spoiled kid. He was an altruistic kid. He took in strays in terms of newcomers to his school. He invited people to, they had parties at the home. But when he went away to school, he went to Vanderbilt University in Nashville, Tennessee, very good school. But in those first couple years, he became gradually alienated from his parents. And his parents didn't cut him off. They didn't use what's known in this country anyways, tough love. They tried to understand what was happening to him. They were very sympathetic. They, you know, offered counseling. He was always welcome back home, even when he became more and more alienated to them. When he decided to drop out of Vanderbilt after his second year, where he was a very good student, he went on projects in Latin America to help people. His professors loved him, but he became interested in New Age beliefs, but also a serious study of Eastern religions, Buddhism and Hinduism. And his parents weren't sure what the source of this alienation was. Sociologically, at least in North America, when young men reach their early 20s, they're sometimes vulnerable to incipient mental illness, particularly bipolar. And Brent Jr.'s parents weren't sure if that's what it was, because there was a family history of bipolar disorder in Charlotte's family.
Right.
And they were petrified that that's what was happening to them. But they did everything they could to support him. He wanted to drop out of Vanderbilt after the second year. They didn't like it, but they accepted it. He wanted to study Buddhism and Hinduism in retreats around the country and in Mexico. And they supported him in that. So they basically did everything they could. But as time passed, he began, as the title of the book says, he began to drift into darkness. And the alienation was greater and greater. When he would come back for family visits, sometimes for big family occasions, the Spring Church had a black tie dinner at Christmas every year for more than 100 people at their home. And he showed up one year in a monk's robe with his head shaved. And his parents were, of course, mortified, but they were saying their explanation was Brent's just trying to find himself.
When did Brent meet Caroline Scout? And under what circumstances?
Well, Brent spent about 2 years with a serious study of Buddhism and Hinduism, going from retreat to retreat in Mexico and across the U.S. He ended up in Boulder, Colorado, where he decided he would study Buddhism formally at Naropa University in Boulder. His parents were not so thrilled with the idea, but they thought, well, he'll be back in school. That'll be good for us. And so they supported that. But, you know, for all of Brent's adult life, he was searching for enlightenment through New Age seeking, through Buddhism and Hinduism. But in the end, it just got darker and darker. He really wanted to find a guru, a spiritual guide. And he went to visit the home of his roommate. His roommate at Naropa's parents lived in Boulder. They had a kind of an intellectual salon, a New Age salon at their home. And he went there one day and he crossed paths with a woman named Caroline Scout, who claimed to be a Native American shaman. And the instant he saw her, he was struck. And he got down on his knees and touched his head to the floor 3 times and said, "I found my spiritual guide." And that was a fateful meeting for Brent. He thought this search that he'd been on for several years was finally satisfied. He found someone who he could follow and learn about and study. He was still at Naropa, so as he was getting to know her, taking breathing classes with her that she gave in Boulder, he wrote a paper about her for Naropa and her history, based, of course, only on what she told him. And he became closer and closer to her. And I think at that time, she sensed in him what we call a mark, a vulnerable person from whom she could extract money.
Now, they have a relationship, and he wants to tell his parents about this person. Their parents are interested in meeting this person that they believe can be a caretaker. Maybe you can explain to us that meeting and what they get from the meeting, this woman, and what they think her interest is regarding their son.
At first, they were relieved that he had found someone who could look after him, someone whose advice he was likely to take. Because as they were concerned with his mental health as well, they thought if he was with a person who would be a caretaker, who he would listen to, they could, in a sense, use her to steer him towards psychiatric care. They weren't sure. And also, Charlotte candidly admitted if he had a caretaker in Boulder, he was less likely to come home to Montgomery and embarrass them again with his state of mind. So they felt this was a good idea. But they were very caring parents, very careful parents. And so they flew out to Boulder to meet this woman. And they were initially impressed with her. They felt she was a very spiritual person. Many people who met her felt she was a very spiritual person. And they left fairly confident that this was going to be a good arrangement. And so to cement that, they began sending Caroline Scout money, ostensibly to take care of Brent, but it was really more money than she would have needed. And so that relationship was sort of christened and approved of by Brent's parents. They were hopeful. They weren't sure, but they were hopeful that this might bring him back to them in some way through her. And in fact, she did begin to get him to see a series of psychiatrists. He was uncertain of it himself, but because she said he should do it, he began to do it.
Now, you talk about this. What is the diagnosis from these various psychiatrists?
Very early on, the psychiatrist diagnoses were sort of reinforced from one to another, for the most part, which is early stages of bipolar disorder. This was troubling to Brent Jr.'s mother because she knew that her family, for three generations at least, had been plagued with bipolar disorder. Mm-hmm. There were in her family suicides, institutionalizing, alcoholism, various things, which she had decided not to tell her son about for fear that he would see that as something that couldn't be avoided for him. And right. So she didn't want it to be an inevitable problem that he should worry about among the other things that he had in his life to worry about. So she recognized that, that was probably the case. And she did what psychiatrists don't really like to do. She began corresponding with his psychiatrist. Most of them, because of the ethics, would not respond to her because he was not a minor. So she had no standing to his psychiatric care. But she was pretty clear that the psychiatrists were onto something, and they prescribed medication. And as often happens with bipolar disorder, the medication, once they get the sort of mix or the cocktail right, results in improvement. But sometimes the improvement, the patient says, well, I'm feeling fine. I don't need the drugs anymore. So then they stop taking the drugs and the cycle repeats.
Now, you talk about that there was a secret that these two, Brent Jr. and Caroline, had that they kept from the parents. And the parents, being supportive and wealthy, decided to buy a home and keep it in their own name, but buy a home so that he could have somewhere to live and support this caregiver. But in reality, what was the living arrangements at that time?
It was very strange. Before they bought the house, while Brent Jr. was still in Boulder, when there was a summer break at Naropa, he told his parents he wanted to go up to Wyoming, where Caroline Scout had a small ranch, and work on her ranch, be a caretaker, and learn about Native American culture, which they agreed to. And that took place through the summer. And then he decided he was going to stay there, that he wouldn't go back to school. He began working at various jobs. Now, up there, he did see a psychiatrist, but his mother felt that a psychiatrist in South Dakota was not the kind of psychiatrist that he needed. So she wanted to get them back to Boulder. But what she didn't know is that after that summer, Caroline Scout drove Brent Jr. across the border into South Dakota to a town, historic town called Deadwood, and they were secretly married. Brent later said he didn't know why she wanted to get married. It was her idea, not his. He didn't realize it, but he knew he was 24, but what he didn't realize is that she was 48, twice his age. And she said, we want to keep this a secret. And so it was a secret. And by that time, which is that this was not a traditional marriage, as they say. There was no sexual relationship between Caroline and Brent Jr. And he was apparently quite content with that. When he moved finally from Caroline's ranch in Wyoming to the house that his parents had purchased in Greeley, Colorado, he wasn't even allowed to sleep not only in her bedroom, he was not allowed to sleep in the house. he built a little living area in the garage, the adjoining garage. And he was not allowed to come into the house without permission from Caroline. And he needed to call her on her cell phone first to get permission to come into the house, which happened, but very rarely. And to her children, Caroline denigrated him, that he was basically a screw up, that he was crazy, and that her caretaking was just basically a paid indulgence for her.
This continues for quite a while, where the parents are supportive, hoping for the very best, thinking that she has his best interest in mind. But eventually, through a bunch of different circumstances, Charlotte and, but especially Brent Sr., believe that there's something amiss. And there eventually is a complaint because these numbers don't add up. The money that they're giving is not got any return on an investment. So they think that Caroline has, they're suspicious of her. As a result, there is talk of withholding money. As a result, what happens with the living arrangement at the house in Colorado, and how is it that he has this kind of information that really paints his parents in a negative light, despite their support of him?
Well, there's an increasing flow over several years of money from the Springfords in Montgomery to Caroline as caretaker in Greeley. And the figures began to really mount up. And it begins with, well, the house, which is not in their name, but they bought the house. They did buy, with title, cars for Caroline and her adult children. They bought clothes. They paid community college tuition, a whole series of benefits that when the paper trail was finally tracked, it was somewhere between $1 million and $1.5 million. There are various improvements on the property. And Brent Jr., who was not a grabby, spoiled kid growing up, began to make increasing demands on his parents. Never in voice, usually in texts or faxes. And the tone of his request, which soon shifted into demands, was very uncharacteristic of Brent Jr. He was basically beginning to treat his parents as an ATM, as a cash machine. And they became suspicious naturally over time. And they had talked amongst themselves as well as with their friends and neighbors and some psychiatrists about when to exercise what's called, as I mentioned before, tough love, when to say, you need to do this if you want me to do this. And the estrangement, when they did that, became really intense until finally they decided they were going to cut both Caroline and Brent Jr. off. Around the same time, Robin was supposed to get married in a big fancy wedding in Alabama. And they decided that Brent had become too unstable to attend. So the Robin had personally invited her brother. Her parents got her to disinvite him right around the time that they decided to cut off the money. And they did. He did not attend the wedding. They did cut off the money. And 6 weeks after the money was cut off, Brent Jr. got on a bus from Boulder, headed toward Montgomery.
Let's use this as an opportunity, Mark, to stop for a second to hear from our sponsor, which is Nutrafol. 80 million men and women in the U.S. experience thinning hair, yet it's still not openly talked about, which can make going through it feel stressful, and that just adds to the problem. Nutrafol is the number one dermatologist-recommended hair growth supplement, clinically shown to improve your hair growth, thickness, and visible scalp coverage for men and women. Did you know that there are multiple causes of thinning hair? Nutrafol is the hair growth supplement that goes beyond genetics to target stress, hormones, nutrition, metabolism, aging, and lifestyle factors that may be impacting your hair. Thinning is different for men and women. Nutrafol has multiple unique formulas for men and women to provide exactly what they need based on their biology and age. Every formula is physician formulated using natural medical grade ingredients for reliable results without compromises. In clinical studies, 72% of men saw more scalp coverage and 86% of women saw improved hair growth after 6 months. Nutrafol is also trusted and recommended by more than 3,000 top doctors. You can grow thicker, healthier hair, and support our show by going to Nutrafol.com and entering promo code SHOCKING to save $15 off your first month subscription. This is their best offer anywhere, and it's only available to U.S. customers for a limited time. Plus free shipping on every order. Get $15 off at Nutrafol.com, spelled Nutrafol.com, promo code SHOCKING. Now, investigators, Mark, have the evidence they need. They have the background to explain how this all occurred, and they have their likely suspect. Tell us about the arrest and what happens afterwards in this investigation.
Well, two detectives from Montgomery went out and joined the sheriff's deputies out in the Greeley area. And as they pursued their initial investigation, it became clearer and clearer that Brent Jr.'s alibi for being in Colorado at the time of the murder was falling apart. And they could see that. And as they kept making visits to Caroline Scout's house, which is obviously the older Springfield's house, to interrogate members of the family and Brent, things were getting shakier and shakier. At that point, they were almost ready to make an arrest, but Brent Jr. preempted them by checking himself into a local psychiatric institute from which they could not get him. While they were waiting to find a way to get him from the institution, surveillance tape was coming in from across from bus stations across the country that were placing Brent Jr. on the way to Montgomery and from Oklahoma, where the Jaguar was discovered, back to Boulder. So they were building a case, but they were under a great deal of pressure because the only physical evidence they found at the Springfords' home in Montgomery, where the murders took place, was one fingerprint from Brent on a banister. But it was not in blood, and there's no way to date the fingerprint in a house that he grew up in. So basically, they had no physical evidence to connect Brent Jr. to the killing. So they were under great pressure back in Montgomery because the parents were such socially prominent people to come up with a solution quickly. And the only way they could do that was, they thought anyway, was to go through Brent himself to get some sort of a confession. So they waited. They got a warrant for his arrest from Montgomery and a request for extradition from Alabama. And they went to the psychiatric institute. It was midnight. The people at the psychiatric facility said they wouldn't release him unless the police showed up with a warrant for his arrest, which they did. It was about midnight. Brent had been sleepless. We don't know for how long. He was also taking psychotropic drugs, some very powerful, yet the institute released him to these police officers. And then something a little strange happened, or maybe more than a little strange happened. Instead of taking Brent right to the Boulder County Jail, where he would have been booked, they took him to a small police station in Louisville, Colorado, which was where the psychiatric institute was. And the two homicide detectives and two local sheriff's deputies sat him down and interrogated him. Yeah. Now, here's a young man, normally troubled, psychiatric history, under the influence of psychotropic drugs, and sleepless, and they begin to interrogate him. They read him as Miranda rights, but the question later emerged, you know, what was his frame of mind? Did he know what he was being asked? Did he know that he was entitled to a lawyer? Notwithstanding, the two Montgomery police officers who I spoke with later said, well, we knew we were on a little shaky ground, but this was all we had. So he thought, we'd go do this. If there's a problem with a confession later, we let the prosecutor deal with that. And so they interrogated him for 4 hours on tape, at which time he gave an account and admission of how and why he bludgeoned his parents, how and why he beat his parents to death. And so with that, they then took him to the Boulder County Jail and booked him into jail. But the Boulder jail officials, one of the things they had to sign a certification that he was mentally capable at the time. And they said he was, but it became obvious to the jail officials that he wasn't because they called in some of their psychologists to talk to him, gave him several tests, including a Rorschach test. And then they had the presence of mind to bring in a local public defender to look out for his rights. But at that time, by that point, you know, the horse was out of the barn as far as the confession goes. And then things were compounded. Brent, while in the jail, well, before when he was in the psychiatric institute, he was calling TV stations around Montgomery, denying that he was involved, but calling sort of everybody he thought of and making disparaging remarks about both the police in Montgomery and the governor of Alabama, which would later do him no good. Later, when he was in the Boulder County jail, he wrote something else, which amounted to a confession, which he gave to a jailer, he said, to give to his attorney, to his public defender. The jail person, those things are privileged. You can't use them. But the jail attendant, nonetheless, made a copy of it and shared that with police authorities. In that written document, he also, Brent Jr., also confessed to the murder, although he gave, there were certain details about who said what happened, the order of things, and what motivated him were somewhat different. But that later went to the police, and that strengthened their hands in their accusations of Brent Jr.'s involvement in the murders.
Through all of this, they do hear and they do assume that maybe this Caroline Scout does not have the best interests at heart with Brent Jr., but also that she may have had some involvement one way or another, either prompting him to do this or being more directly involved. And yet Brent, despite anything, is very, very protective of Caroline in this regard. And in fact, another thing that you point out was very, very, very interesting and would lead police to be very suspicious is that because they were married, she was not, would not be forced whatsoever to testify against her husband. And yet she gave crucial information, incriminating information to police voluntarily, didn't she?
She did, which was very curious and became curiouser and curiouser, as Alice in Wonderland once said. As to whose interest she had at the foremost. She visited him, but she shared much of what he told her with investigators, which was very strange. And they weren't sure why. And part of his protection of her, one, he would never implicate her in any way in the killing itself. But when Caroline Scout gave, you know, she basically lied to investigators initially about where he was. So that would leave her vulnerable to accessory after the fact, if not accessory as an accessory. And they let her come back with a lawyer and retract the lies that she had told investigators previously. And Brent Jr. seemed fixated with the idea that she should not be in any way vulnerable to any kind of prosecution. He was adamant about that, and he would remain adamant about that for years that followed.
Now, this was a capital case, and so this was a different dynamic in terms of what their intention was as defense team, and their goal was to save his life, obviously, and so they only had a couple options, and so what did they decide to do in terms of defense, and how did that work out? And lead us to this trial.
Their first line of defense was to prove that he was mentally incompetent, either to stand trial or to have committed what the crime was. And in the U.S. judicial system, in a case like this, the question of mental competence gets down to an issue of dueling shrinks, as we say. So the defense would hire psychiatrists to evaluate, knowing the history of these psychiatrists, that they were amenable to finding someone incompetent, whereas the prosecutor would go and recruit psychiatrists who were known to have a bias against finding mental incompetence. So that was the first line of defense. That took several years, and they went back and forth and back and forth. And finally, the defense lost that. It became clear that although they knew that Brent Jr. was crazy or getting crazier from their own dealings with him and more difficult to defend, the ruling was that he was not incompetent to stand trial. And so there were then two lines of defense that were secondary. One was to get a change of venue from Montgomery, where the case was huge news day after day. And the second line of of that defense was to have the three now, by net, this time three confessions by Brent, thrown out because he was not properly protected when he gave those confessions. So the first two motions took a long time to adjudicate. The first one was the defense won a change of venue from Montgomery to Birmingham, which was about an hour away. Now, it was a great victory, not so much because he would have a better shot at a trial in Birmingham, but in order to move the trial from Montgomery to Birmingham, it would be an added expense to Montgomery County. It would cost them an extra $250,000 that was not budgeted. And so pressure then was on the prosecutor. Do you want to have to go to the county commission and ask for another $250,000? Now, that's not a yes or no proposition, but it factored into the decision of whether the prosecutor wanted to deal away the death penalty. Once the death penalty went off the table, then the trial would probably remain in Montgomery with a pleading. The issue of the confessions, which is also critical, was not adjudicated. So they were sort of hanging out there. But the prosecution knew that if the judge threw out the three confessions, all they had left was bus station surveillance tape. They had no physical connection to put Brent in Montgomery in that house, and no other way to prove that Brent Jr. committed these murders, other than the fact that they could prove that he went from Boulder to Montgomery and then went from, on the way back, from Tulsa to Boulder. So that those are different factors that the prosecutor had to weigh in whether to accept a plea. Another issue was the Springford family. Robin, the surviving daughter, and her husband, Greg, were thought to be really pressing hard for the death penalty. Now, the prosecutor didn't need to get their permission, but by practice, they consult. So these were all the factors that the prosecutor, Ellen Brooks, was weighing as to whether she would be amenable to a deal that would take the death penalty off the table, but would result in a guilty plea. In Alabama, the prosecutor is an elected position, so she always has to be careful about, you know, what this might mean to her politically, because she had asked for the death penalty before in other cases where the accused were people of color and poor, and it might not look good for her to take the death penalty off the table for a young man who was white and from a wealthy background.
So tell us what happens at trial. What is the outcome?
At trial, they had finally, they thought, convince Brent Jr. to accept a plea of life in prison without the possibility of parole, with the understanding that he would be housed in a secure psychiatric prison unit. But up until the time in the courtroom, which was required, that the judge accepted the plea, there was really uncertainty on both the prosecutor and the defense team as to whether Brent, who was getting very, very shaky mentally, would be able to accept the deal in a way that the judge could accept. Because if he was unstable, he would be too unstable to accept the deal, and the whole deal would go down the drain. So on the day of the pleading, everybody was on tenterhooks. The judge, the prosecutor, the defense attorneys, and everybody was hoping that they could get through this. And when they first went through the procedure that they needed to, Brent seemed to wobble a little bit. And so they asked him to sit down. There was a conference at the judge's bench with both sides. And they tried to work out really ad hoc a quick wording and strategy that Brent Jr. would agree to. They finally did that. The plea was accepted. Brent pleaded guilty. He was sentenced to life in prison without parole. And the judge advised, which is all he could do, the State Department of Corrections to house Brent in a secure psychiatric prison unit.
Let's use this as an opportunity to stop for these messages. Now, you talked that people feared that under the condition that he was in, that this might be, in fact, a death sentence regardless. So what happens?
Well, at first, Brent seems well adjusted. When he's in the Montgomery County Jail, he was not convicted until he pleaded guilty. So the conditions were fairly relaxed. He could come and go from his cell. He had access to books and writing materials. He had access to radio. And because he had become, you know, so involved in his spiritual quest that as a Buddhist and a Hindu from both traditions, he felt, well, this is just, I'm going to view this as a monk's cell, and I'll just pretend that I'm in a monastery, so it can't be that bad. But after he pleaded guilty, he was sent to the state prison system where things were a lot more difficult and a lot more stringent. And he had to give up many of his books. He had to give up his radio, and he did not adjust well. He wanted a cell by himself, which they agreed to. He began seeing a prison psychiatrist, but the prison psychiatrist communicated with a member of Brent's defense team to say Brent's long-term prognosis was not good, that his mental condition was likely to deteriorate, and there's no telling how it would all end. And although Brent Jr.'s friends and family rallied around him, and they ordered him books, they sent money to his commissary account to buy toiletries and candy, et cetera, and they wrote to him, he continued his mental descent, and he finally was transferred for various reasons, some his request, some the prison's request, and he wasn't doing well at all. And there was another transfer that he was ordered to do, and he said, if you transfer me again, I'll kill myself. Well, in prisons, people do say those things, and they don't always do it. But in Brent's case, he wasn't posturing. He had a script or a prescription for Tylenol for his various ailments, among others, and he simply stored them up, and he took them all at once, and he had liver failure in his jail cell, and he died.
In this trial, there was a person that's a crucial character in here, and her name was Susan Wardell. And her specialty, well, she was a mitigation specialist. So tell us, now that he is dead, how you become involved, and who is Susan Wardell and her involvement going forward?
Susan Wardell is my wife's sister, my wife's older sister. Both my wife, her sister, and I were at Duke University together in the late 1960s. I didn't know either of them at the time, but Susan was there. Susan graduated from Duke. She had been married, and then she was divorced. And later in life, she went back to school, the university, first to get a degree in clinical social work and then to get a degree in law. So she was both an attorney and a clinical social worker. And she gravitated to a specialty called death penalty mitigation, which meant that the federal courts have decided, as they've narrowed the window for the death penalty, that if you have a client as a defense attorney who you think is likely to face the prospect of the death penalty at the end of a trial, at the beginning of the trial, you need to hire someone, a mitigation specialist. And that specialist's job was to create a profile of the defendant, apart from their guilt or innocence, that wasn't a factor, but a psychological profile, sympathetic, that could be presented at the end of the trial to either the prosecutor, the judge, or a jury if they go to a penalty phase, to say, you shouldn't kill this person. They never did anything wrong before. They were abused. There was a drug addiction in the family, or they had all these troubles. So that was Susan Wardell's job. She did it, although she's an Atlanta native, she did it mostly in Alabama because there were so many death penalty cases in Alabama, and she got very good at it. So when Brent Jr. was extradited back to Montgomery and assigned two very capable criminal defense attorneys, they employed Susan Wardell to handle this case. Now, most of the defendants that she worked with, because of the demography of the death penalty in America, were people of color and indigent in some way. Brent Jr. was quite different. He was college educated. He was white. He was upper middle class, if not more. And she developed an affinity for him, and a real sympathy for him. So she went, way beyond what she would normally do for a client because she felt so personally close to him. He was about the age of Wardell's own two children.
Right.
And as Wardell did more investigation, the sinister presence of Caroline Scout began to insinuate itself in her theory of the case. But she couldn't get Brent Jr. to cop to that, to roll on her. He would not hear of anything negative about Caroline Scout, which was very frustrating to Susan Wardell. And then when Brent killed himself in prison, Susan Wardell was just incensed. She felt that the person who was really responsible for these murders, Caroline Scout, had gotten away scot-free. There was no evidence now to connect her, and that she had escaped justice. And that infuriated Wardell.
Now, you write about fate and another person that ends up dead, and Caroline Scout involved, this Sandy Campbell. Tell us about this event.
Well, Susan Wardell convinced me because my previous true crime book had come out in 2013. Susan Wardell convinced me that I had to write a book that would bring Caroline Scout to justice. And she sent me all this wonderful for journalist material, emails, letters, personal journals, interviews, et cetera, which she sent to me as an inducement to write the book. I went through that material. I was convinced, I was persuaded, and I agreed to research the book. When I finished her files, I began doing my own research in Montgomery, and I thought I was finished with this case. I was ready to write the book, but I thought, well, I better go to Boulder just in case. So I went out to Boulder, did some more research and reporting. I worked with a private investigator who had worked with the defense team. And then I thought, okay, I did my due diligence. I'm coming back to, at that time, Florida. And it couldn't have been more than a few days later when I heard from the private investigator. He said, "You'll never believe what happened. They found another body up on Caroline Scout's ranch in Wyoming, and it's an apparent suicide." I thought, whoa. So I began to investigate that. He began to investigate that, and I convinced the Wyoming sheriff's people to begin to investigate that. And it turned out that this new victim, Sandy Campbell, had known Brent was from Boulder before he went up there. He had known Brent Jr. They were friends. He was also psychologically fragile. And then in a more sinister development, two insurance policies popped up on Sandy Campbell's life, which named Caroline Scout as the sole beneficiary, even though Campbell had a daughter that he was close to. So the police, at my urging, would not sign a death certificate putting the cause of death at suicide, because that would trigger payment of the insurance company on those claims. So that's when the plot thickened, and I got to be friendly for some reason, I still don't know why, with a deputy sheriff out there who listened to me and paid attention to me, which, you know, police homicide people don't like civilians getting themselves involved. Particularly, they don't like journalists getting involved. But this person, Detective Sergeant Patrick Watsabaugh, listened to me, and he said, "Okay, we won't sign the death certificate." And then later he said, "Well, Caroline keeps calling and calling. We want to know why we won't sign the death certificate." Well, one reason was the suicide was a shooting, and the closer they looked at it, the more hinky it looked. The physical evidence did not really line up with the story that Caroline was telling about what happened. And so Detective Watsabaugh told me, he said, "Mark, if you fly out here, you can help us, and I'll get you an interview with Caroline Scout." I said, "Patrick, how can you do that?" He said, "I'll take care of it." So I said, "Okay." I went out to, flew into South Dakota, then drove over into Wyoming. And in fact, through a series of events, Watsabaugh was able to get me face to face with Caroline Scout. She wasn't sure the capacity that I was there for, which worked in my favor, at least for most of the interview. But I was able to sit face to face with her for 2 hours and do an interview. She didn't admit anything. That I never thought she would, but at least I had the opportunity to speak with her. When we left the interview, Watsabaugh said, "We're going to convene on Monday a task force to look into this case and the previous case. Would you be willing to come and join us?" And I thought, okay. I mean, this never happens. Cops never ask a journalist to sit in and help. So I thought, okay, let's do it. And so that Monday morning, there was assembled in the sheriff's department in Weston County, Wyoming, two coroners, a coroner's investigator, and Sergeant Watsabaugh. And we all convened. Everybody brought the documents that they had generated by looking into the case. And I was asked to be the first speaker. And the first thing they asked me about was the Springford murders and how they may be similar, how they might have been similar, or the dynamic between Scout and Brent Jr., how that might replicate or be similar to the dynamic between Caroline Scout and Sandy Campbell, the most recent body found on her property. And so I basically became, you know, a central part of this task force looking into this case.
This task force had a end goal, and everybody involved in wanting to, that was involved in the Springford case, but also now in the Campbell case, wanted to bring this Caroline to justice and have her testify. So what is the strategy leading up to this coroner's inquest? What do they ultimately want to do and compel her to do? And what would they like to have the prosecution ultimately have happen?
The two coroners who worked together wanted the local criminal prosecutor in Weston County to bring charges against Caroline associated with the death of Sandy Campbell on her property, also with some related scams that they turned up in their investigation. But despite all the legwork that they did in giving information to the local prosecutor, he just thought the case was too complicated for him to get into and he wouldn't do anything about it. So the next route that the coroners took, they contacted the Wyoming State Bureau of Investigation, who had the jurisdiction, if they wanted to assert it, to come in and look into the case. They agreed to look into the case, but they weren't sure how long that would take. So the coroners decided if the prosecutor won't bring a criminal proceeding, we'll bring what's known as a coroner's inquest, which is by statute to determine the cause and circumstances of the death. And they decided they would make a coroner's inquest, basically a trial of Caroline Campbell, and put forth to a coroner's jury all the information that they were able to turn up and all the information that I was able to turn up and all the information that the private investigator in Denver and Boulder was able to turn up, in hopes of using a coroner's inquest verdict to further pressure either the local prosecutor or the State Department of Investigation to bring criminal charges in a criminal court against Caroline Scout. And even if they couldn't, they wanted to put Caroline Scout on trial because there was no other way, they thought, to bring her to justice.
They thought that putting her on the stand or compelling her to be on the stand, they were confident that would happen, but they might get something, derive something from that. She does go to this inquest. What happens?
A good lawyer, and he did everything he could because she had never, to our knowledge, Caroline Scout has never been in a courtroom where she was placed under oath. And the jeopardy is if she did testify at the coroner's inquest and she lied, if not for her involvement in either of the killings, she would be subject to a perjury charge. So her lawyer went back and forth until he finally said, if you call her, we will assert her Fifth Amendment rights and say to the coroner's jury, she is asserting her Fifth Amendment rights of not incriminating herself, but she would not physically be on the stand because under Wyoming law, if your client is likely to take our Fifth Amendment against self-incrimination, you couldn't keep asking her the same question. If you knew that that person was going to assert their Fifth Amendment rights, you couldn't actually put them on the stand. It would be considered prejudicial because the jurors might take the implication that she had something to hide. So she, in the final analysis, she showed up in the courtroom with her attorney, but she was at the back of the room. Her attorney asserted her right, and she escaped being compelled to testify in the coroner's inquest.
With this pursuit, as you call it, yourself and everyone else trying to get criminal charges to take this further, what is the result of that pursuit? And what happens to Caroline Scout?
Well, the coroner's jury came back with a verdict of homicide, which is to say murder in the case of Sandy Campbell. Afterward, they did not name the person in their ruling. They did not name the person. But after the ruling was announced, they said that they believed that Caroline Scout was responsible for the death of Sandy Campbell for profit. That induced the state's investigators to continue their investigation. But while that was dragging on, Caroline Scout moved to Indiana and died of natural causes. So there was no reason for there to be a report from the state police. And so the only record we have, the only decision we have, was from the coroner's inquest.
To wrap up this incredible story, you reflect. What did you learn from this? And as you write in Reflections, what is your conclusion, if any, from this incredible journey into the facts of this case?
I take a layered view of how and why the story of four tragic deaths unfolded so inexorably, a view that spreads responsibility for the tragedy in Montgomery and what took place afterward in Boulder and Wyoming. As a parent, I can't fault Charlotte Springford for trying to involve herself in her son's life and psychiatric treatment. To one doctor, she wrote, quote, "We love him so much and we are so frightened for him." The larger question, it seems to me, is how might Brent's parents have distinguished between his neediness and entitlement his sincere spiritual quest, an incipient, possibly hereditary mental illness. Then how soon should they have recognized the venal, malign influence of Caroline Scout, for whom they placed so much faith and hope? For that, I have no answer. When Susan Wardell first brought the Springford case to my attention in 2009, there were two dead people, Charlotte and Brent Springford Sr. Brent Jr. and Richard Campbell, Sandy, were still alive. By the time I left Wyoming in 2016, there were four dead. I wish the outcome could have been otherwise. The Caroline Scout would have faced the jury for her role in the Springford and Campbell deaths. But nothing more Wardell or various law enforcement officials, and certainly not me, could do was able to change that. However, when I first approached the members of the Springford and Campbell families, as well as defense and law enforcement officials in Alabama, Colorado, and Wyoming, I told them that regardless of how the judicial process played out, this book would be the murder trial that Caroline Scout never had.
Absolutely. I want to thank you very much, Mark I. Pinsky, for talking about your incredible book, Drifting Into Darkness, Murders, Madness, Suicide, and a Death Under Suspicious Circumstances. For those that might want to take a look at more information and other books that you've written, is there an Amazon page and is there a website, please?
There's a website, which is www.markpinsky, one word, markpinsky.com. I'm also on Facebook. There's a lot of material on Facebook as well. And I have a presence on other social platforms as well, TikTok and Twitter, et cetera. So you should be able to find me in the book, or you could just go to New South, one word, books, newsouthbooks.com, and you'll find as much as you would need to know about the book right there.
Thank you very much, Mark I. Pinsky, Drifting Into Darkness, Murders, Madness, Suicide, and a Death Under Suspicious Circumstances. It's been incredible. Thank you so much. You have a great evening. Good night.
Good night. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.